this is the Squirrel Report, as you know, because you downloaded
it. This is our
300th
episode.
It is. It is our 300th episode. And we have a special guest. We have we have Joel Greenberg on with us. Joel, well, I'll let him toot his own horn, but he's spent a lot of time in the Navy on submarines and some other stuff, and he accepted our call for interesting people to guest host. It's funny that nobody. I get a lot of comments from people going, "Oh, I'm not interesting enough." Joel is interesting enough, so.
Alan, that's a good point. And when I talked to you the other day, I stressed the same thing. You are more interesting than you think. Yep. And the stuff you think was just so routine and unnoticeable that you've done in your life was not.
Yeah.
Mm.
That it really meant something. And if you sit down and figure out how it fits in, you'd be amazed at what you really did in your life.
That's right.
So, Joel, you want to tell us a little bit about yourself?
Well, let me start. I'd like to start. Yeah, you're going to get all of that. If I give you a few minutes on submarines, it's all going to fit in.
Okay.
Okay.
Yes.
The first thing I want to start is something that I said to Alan the other day.
Okay.
And that is, he's a Marine, and I'm a submariner. And I'm wearing a hat. Yes, that's really good for radio and podcasts. I'm wearing a hat that says the best Marine is a submarine.
Ah, boy.
So, correct me if I'm wrong, Joel, but that makes you a bubblehead, right?
That's a term that people use. I have, to the truth, I've never been fond of that term. But yes, that's legit, by the way.
All right. I have a friend who is a submariner and refers to himself in that way. So I was not aware it was less than desirable.
That could just be me. You know, I have these crazy things, which you'll find out soon enough. What I want to say, as we go on, and this brings in submarines in, and then I fit into the picture. For Alan, there's a saying, once a Marine, always a Marine. And for the submariners, the saying is that you can take the sailor out of the submarine, you cannot take the submarine out of the sailor. And I, here at age 73, am proof of that, having been doing that, and then many, many other things in the Navy besides that, including the gun line in Vietnam, and various other Navy things that I did because I went into the Supply Corps later on. And I've been retired since 1988, so that's a lot of years, doing all kinds of different things past that. But you cannot take the submarine out of the sailor. And here at age 73... I still hang around with submariners, and I'm the immediate past commander of Tucson Base, United States Submarine Veterans. So there you go. And
it just sort of sticks to you, doesn't it?
It does indeed. I've decided, and I've gone through with this already, that on my tombstone, I've already got this all planned because I'm going to the VA cemetery down here in Arizona. That it's going to say, always a submariner on my tombstone.
That's pretty awesome, Joel.
Even though I was a Supply Corps officer in the Navy for more years than I was officially a line officer submariner. But that's part of the explanation of all who I am. We start with the... something I want to mention, Alan, when you emailed back and forth, you discovered that I am living in Arizona. I'm in the one state that remains on standard time year round.
Yep.
And I remember someone else saying this. If you hear me saying some of these crazy things, I probably picked them up from somebody else. Cut off one end of a blanket, sew it on the other end, and say it's now longer.
Yeah, it's crazy.
Interesting.
And then do the reverse at the end of the season, you know.
That's right. First definition we have here is, you'll hear people, besides bubblehead, you'll hear people say submariner. It's submariner is really, the definition of submariner is a below par sailor.
Submariner is an underwater sailor. Well, we don't want to say that.
Believe me, I have said that to people who weren't pleased that I said that to them, who had some positions of authority and responsibility in doing things, saying, no, you're never going to call me a submariner. And a submariner, in addition to that, is a person who operates shit you can't. Oops, did I just out Navy language? Oh, my goodness, sailor talk.
And That's perfectly acceptable.
I know that, but, you know... having invested 20 years in Uncle Sugar's Canoe Club, I just showed you how I know how to play sailor. Okay. If I were a retired officer, I can still play sailor. We like to think of it, and some people over the years have said it's a calling. It's not a job. And it's an earned brotherhood, which it is. You know, we wear dolphins that sort of look like wings, but they're not wings. And I'll talk about a little more about that in a little bit. If I might, and Alan knows that I wanted to depart from submariner for a minute. Rita.
Yes, sir.
I wanted to talk to you about two topics.
Okay.
Okay?
Yep.
The topic is... As a submariner, you're never not a submariner. And I walk around with hats with dolphins on them all the time. I'm currently the newsletter editor for our USS Seafox Association. Seafox was one of the three boats I was on. And submarines are boats. And you serve in the boats. When you're on a surface ship, you serve on the ship.
Oh.
But submarines, yeah, so I'm a boat sailor. I do the newsletter, and when I need filler to fill up pages and things to help, mm-hmm. When articles don't go down the whole page or something, I take some editorial license and I publish what I call random thoughts from your editor.
Okay.
And about, this was right after you said this. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Title. Have we truly entered the digital age? While listening to a podcast the other day, I heard a librarian mention she had a patron come up to her and ask for the time. Surprised, she pointed to the clock on the wall behind her desk. It was our old-fashioned analog clock. Analog is a modern word for circular clocks with a second minute in our hands of differing shapes and lengths. In this digital age, this library patron could not tell the time. Really? Have we lost the concept of quarter after, half past, quarter till? Are these clocks going the way of sundials? And so, Brita, stuff that gets said on podcasts is remembered, heard, understood, and passed on.
Oh, cool. I think that's great.
Second topic is, you like to repeat about and talk about your Irish heritage and your ancestors. Well, you read my story that I sent you guys. I become a storyteller. Clearly, you can tell that from the way I'm talking now. But I write the same way as I talk. And you read my story in short. And the first name that appeared in the bio was the guy who set all the chain of events to go throughout history that ended with me being here today with you guys as a submariner.
Mm-hmm.
And then at the end of the story, I thanked him. Well, that was Donald Derricks. That was my dad's first cousin.
Mm-hmm.
My dad's mother, my grandmother, and Donald's mother were sisters. They were sisters. They were born and raised on a farm in northern Wisconsin. And their surname was Culligan.
Oh, hey. Okay.
I'm one quarter Irish Catholic and three quarters Russian Jew.
How did that work out?
Well, it was raised Jewish, quite Jewish. Okay. And as a matter of fact, it's continued on. My grandkids, and this, my daughter told me this recently. I have two daughters. One has our grandkids. And she told me this recently, but that our grandkids, who are Jewish and fairly religious about it, they're fairly young too, but have a Hispanic surname.
Oh my gosh.
Got to stand up in class at school on St. Paddy's Day when they said, anybody with Irish blood, stand up. And, they and came home and were so thrilled that they could do that. And I, and so I wanted to pass that on to you.
That's like quite a melting pot just in your own family.
Yep. Yes.
That's you great.
Being Irish all the time, I thought, you know, that would be of some interest to you.
That is pretty neat.
And Alan, if I may, I didn't say this to you earlier, but there is a current event that fits.
Okay.
In this day and age about submariners, and that is, what's the president doing now? He's trying to form a space force.
Right.
And about I think it was 2 years ago in my Random Thoughts column, I wrote this: space exploration. Why not submariners? Landings and launchings by pilots, but going around for long periods of time in vast stretches of three-dimensional, wide-open space, sitting up in a tube that we lovingly call the people pipe, marine natural environment.
That's a good point.
Yeah, after all, we submariners, any of you guys listening to this podcast who are aviators or fly or do a lot of that, we're the other three-dimensional warriors. And we were the first, and that goes back to the war independence, where the turtle was used in New York Harbor off Manhattan Island.
Mm-hmm.
We were then officially formed in 1911. For the U.S. Navy submarine force on April 11th, which connects with something else that I sent to you, because April 11th, you know, my birthday is on April 22nd, which is what is April 22nd? What is April 22nd?
Oh God, I didn't know there was going to be a pop quiz. Yes. Oh no.
How many years did I go every night of the week and go teach college to?
Earth Day.
It's Earth Day.
And why April 22nd?
Because it's Lenin's birthday.
That's right.
Wow.
Yeah, and because I have all this Russian heritage, does that mean he's my older twin brother from another mother? No. Actually, April 22nd is twice April 11th, and April 11th is the official day credited with the birth of United States Navy Submarine Service. And somehow, I'm convinced, where John Holland rolled out the turtle, that somehow there's some outside forces at work there, besides Donald Derrick's, and which I'll get to later on, that ended with me going into submarines. And so this has told you some things about me, and I think that covers it. We're the other three, and because we're the other 3D warriors, there was a movie that came out quite a while ago called Top Gun.
Mm-hmm.
And about naval aviators off carriers. Well, sometime in the past, since then, we submariners have become calling ourselves Bottom Gun, and now I'm taking my best Marine hat off and putting on a hat that says Bottom Gun, which has a matching T-shirt to go with it. Okay. And believe me, most people don't know what it is. I walked into a restaurant one time wearing the Bottom Gun hat, and a retired
Air Force guy called me over and said, were you the turret gunner on the bottom of one of the...
oh!
So, and if the if any of listeners want to really get an easy way to read, to learn about what the stuff that I'm talking about, there's a book out. It's a, and I, what did you say, Alan? It was only $5 now?
Something like that. There's a paperback, yeah.
Okay, called Heroes Beneath the Waves by Mary Nita Smith. And it's a bunch of stories put together. Short stories, medium stories, but not very long. She did most of the editing. I think she wrote a couple of the stories. With, for full disclosure, I have a connection to the book. She asked me for help. Right? And so she acknowledges my help in the acknowledgments.
I'll put a link to it when in the...
Yeah, we should definitely put a link.
Show post.
Yep. And she gave me credit for giving her permission to print a couple of stories that from the newsletters that I edited. Not that I wrote, that somebody else wrote. And she put in two stories that I wrote. So that's full disclosure. But the book is great. I have read it cover to cover a couple of times. It's an easy read, and it starts, as it should, with the turtle. So, and the story that I have in there is a version of the story I sent you.
Yeah.
Now, what I was looking at doing was one other thing about us three-dimensional warriors that are submariners. For the aviators, there's something called gravity. What goes up must come down, and they get to come down sometimes mm-hmm. in one place and sometimes not. But we submariners, because of gravity, what goes down, guess what?
Right.
Come back up.
Huh. You know, Joel, I have often wondered what is like the actual day-to-day kind of experience on a submarine.
Well,
it's not like you have windows. You can't look out the window.
No, you can't.
And what is like a day-to-day type thing on a submarine? I mean, it seems very restricted and tight quarters and
they're
like the guy that you're next to, that sort of thing.
The submarines I was on, the three submarines I was on, you can go around the country and you'll find submarine museums that you can tour, the old world, several World War II boats. Alan was on the Kavala in Texas, and I don't know if there's one in Ohio.
There is.
We have the USS Cod.
Okay.
Yeah.
They're all very similar.
And I've lived here my whole life. I've never been on it.
Yeah.
How
far away is it in the harbor near you?
Yeah, it's just in downtown Cleveland. So it's maybe 15, 20 minutes away. I've never gone on it.
Okay.
Never taken the tour. I don't know why.
Yeah. That would be a good sign. I am very prejudiced. And Alan knows this. We talked about that. I'm a DBFer.
Okay.
Is that bad language? No.
What's DBFer?
Diesel boats forever.
Okay.
That was started way back when, and Alan verified this. He went on the internet to verify that I wasn't telling a fib. And I can't say how far back, but the nukes were following Rusky subs around, and one of the nukes couldn't make his calling. They sent a diesel boat after to take his place. Do we call ships she or he? You know, they're boats to me anyways, even if they're nukes. So that's sort of substitutes for a patrol pin, meaning, hey, we just stuck it to you, old nuke sailor up here. And there's several nukes. I had a constant battle with somebody in Phoenix, in the submarine group up in Phoenix, a running battle with him over DBA. And everybody in my submarine group here in Tucson knows that. Because I'm such a hardcore diesel sailor that it's unbelievable. But in the diesel boats, you could
we're officially 311 feet long. Inside the people pipe, which is inside all the ballast tanks, it's 15 feet, maybe. I don't know. And if you're just going on local ops for training, you're busy because you're going out on Monday, coming back on Friday afternoon, and you're meeting up with destroyers or some other ships, and you're pretending you're shooting torpedoes at them or what have you. Or one time we took some reservists out for a couple of days and just let them walk around and see what's going on. But generally, it can be quite boring. At the time I was, all this fancy electronics didn't exist. I had a reel-to-reel tape player that I could fit in a little compartment outboard my bunk, and then I could wear earphones on it for it and listen to it. But basically, what you found is that if you were not on watch and you didn't have some specific work to do, and believe me, because we didn't have the electronics, so all we got underway was a broadcast.
Oh.
And it was low frequency, very low frequency. We had a trailing wire. We would trail, we'd be at periscope depth, and we would trail the wire, we'd trail under the surface of the water, and we would copy the broadcast. The broadcasts were designed to be one length, and then it repeated and repeated, so that the enemy, the Ruskies, couldn't figure out something was different. And if there wasn't enough stuff to tell us, then they'd fill it up with the news, and then our radioman would print the news and put it on the cruise mess table, and or put it on another copy that they give to the skipper, and then he'd give it to the officers and chiefs. And that was the extent of it. And so you're basically after about a few days underway, and if you were not heading back, you were done with things you were going to do, because the broadcast was not going to give you work to do. It was really going to give you an assignment to go someplace. And it was what was called an uno dir assignment, unless otherwise directed. We are not like the surface fleet or the Army or the Air Force, but really the Army and the Marines do a lot of coordinated stuff, and the surface fleet does a lot of coordinated stuff. I learned about that in my 2.5 years I spent on the Francis Hammond. And so it was just, we'd go follow instructions, and we were trained, and they knew that we would just go. And then the lights would go out in the berthing spaces almost around the clock. They'd be on for a cleanup every day, and would have the lights dimmed in both torpedo rooms, because crew berthed in both torpedo rooms as well. And it would just be kept that way. And the control room and the conning tower, I was on submarine. The old diesel boats still had conning towers. And the post-World War II diesel submarines did not. There was just a few of them. And you go back to your bunk. Or in the case of the crew and the chiefs, they might be playing cribbage or AC Ducey or something like that. You might or might not get a game like that going in the wardroom, but officers might have some paperwork. You could, if you were taking a correspondence class, you could study for that. I mean, you couldn't turn in anything. In today's day and age, they can just stick up the antenna and pick up a satellite and do all the stuff, you know, that we're doing on the phones right now. But we could not do that. So, yes, was it boring? Yes. If it was like that, if you were doing something special that you had to be extra prepared for instance, on the deployment I made on the Sea Fox, we spent time doing market time. Market time is the waters of Vietnam, mostly done by the surface ships. That's looking for bad guys on the surface and then pulling them over or shooting at them. And all we could do was intend to tell somebody else. We've spent some time doing that. And I think we did that so that was so we were there long enough to collect the medal. And that's not saying anything out of turn, okay?
Yeah.
Listen, I didn't need to do that because when I went to the Francis Hammond and spent all two deployments on the gun line, I got all the medals I ever want. Most everything I wear is from the Francis Hammond. It is. On a surface ship is a whole different game because you can, even back then, you did underway replenishments, you got mail, you got stores, you got fuel, you got ammunition. You could send people, get people on board. You can send people off. You know, when we were on in the South China Sea, at the Jewish high holidays, they heloed me over to the carrier, and the carrier collected all the Jewish personnel from all the ships and had the high holiday services.
Oh, wow!
If I remember I'm trying to remember which one it was, but I think it was either the Coral Sea or the Midway. And the Midway is the carrier that's in San Diego.
I've been on that one. That's a fantastic.
That's one of the small. You know, that's tiny compared to.
Yeah, yeah. It seems large when you're standing on it, but it's an amazing example of what they can do with a museum ship with enough money and interest behind it. Worth a visit if you're ever in San Diego. In fact, that whole area is fantastic.
And I think the Dolphin is there too, but I don't think it's next to the Midway. I think there's another little location. Wasn't there a sailing ship that's open to the public?
Yeah, there's a sailing ship that was used, the Surprise, HMS Surprise. And there's a Russian submarine that's there.
Right.
As well.
You can tour the Russian submarine. I did.
I don't remember its name, but it's there.
And I think they brought the USS Dolphin over there someplace. The USS Dolphin was just a R&D submarine homeported out of San Diego for many years. It was a tiny little thing and never got underway with more than 5 or 10 units at a crew of about 15 or 20.
Oh, wow. It's a teeny one.
And it was strictly for R&D. It was in the deep submergence on the unclassified side of the deep submergence project, and you can look at in my bio. I spent 3 years as assistant program manager for that, and so I've been aboard the Dolphin, and we had a nuke one that was just as small called the NR1. It was on the East Coast, and when they got underway because they really couldn't do anything, they had. Back in the day, what did they call the ovens that were on airplanes before we had microwaves and that could heat the food? Were they?
It's like, was it a convection oven or?
Anyways, they had meals that were. I don't know if you put the ready to eat meals in there, and they went underway and they ate MREs. And,
oh boy!
Yeah, both of those boats.
Yuck. Here, go on a submarine and eat MREs.
Well, they went, because there were some surface ships that accompanied them. We had some converted LSTs that worked with them. There was a ship called the USS Point Loma. It was officially the mothership for the DSRVs, which stand for Deep Submergence Rescue Vehicles, which no longer exist. Because the modern submarines can go deeper than the DSRVs can go. They could rescue us. Yeah. We had a test step on the submarines I was on, and it's not classified at 400 feet.
That brings up another question I asked you earlier that I thought was interesting is because we have all these hurricanes around right now, and this was actually something inspired by somebody else that was a friend of mine on Facebook, is if you were sailing on a submarine underneath a hurricane, would you feel it? And at first, my first guess was probably not, because you're under the waves, but I guess that's not entirely accurate.
No, I'm going to go back to the beginning on this. I was a Pacific sailor. In the Pacific, we have no hurricanes. We have typhoons.
Right.
Right.
Same thing. Yeah. No difference. And have I been in a lot of typhoons?
on the submarine, several on the Sea Fox, because the Sea Fox was my longest submarine tour. And I did my one submarine deployment on the Sea Fox. And then when I went to the Hammond, I hate to tell you how many typhoons I was in on the Hammond, because I did two deployments to the South Pacific and the South China Sea over and over and over, you know. But on submarines, in the old diesel boats, you were shaped such that you had a zero buoy balance point. So if you were surfacing or submerging, if you reached that point and a wave, the wrong kind of wave hit you, it could cause damage. It could roll you over quite a bit, okay? So we made it a habit on the Sea Fox of staying on the surface when we weren't someplace we weren't supposed to be. When we were places where it's okay for us to be. We stayed on the surface, rode them out on the surface. I told you the story that the engineer and I were on the bridge, and it's what they call a northern sail on the Sea Fox. The Sea Fox and the Catfish, when they came from the World War II submarines, they had four diesel engines on a dinghy, and they had screw guards around the screws, and they had just a little conning tower type of thing with guns mounted, anti-aircraft and machine guns, Madusas, mounted there, and one gun either forward or aft, a big gun. I don't remember if they were 3 or 4 or 5 inches, but when I was aboard, we didn't have those. And so they were prepared to be, you know, to be on the surface, and they could stay. We didn't have any of that stuff. But like I told you, I don't know how I got way over there. I strayed way away. So I know where I was going. Then after the war, the first thing they did is they took the screw guards off the screws because they weren't worried about the screws cutting people up anymore. They always thought that was a problem, but it got in the way and helped give a bigger sonar picture to the enemy. And the first thing they did was gave the submarines a snorkel. And so they fared in the snorkel. So it's really still an open bridge, low, right above the main deck. Just one human being's tallness above the main deck. So if you look at all of that, you're going to take, and you had a hull like a surface ship. The bow was shaped like a surface ship. You cut into the water.
Right.
Then they moved on to rounding the, and the Segundo was like that. The only conversion from World War II that it had was it had a snorkel put on it, and it was a fairing around the snorkel, and the guns were taken off, and the dinghy was taken out. What the dinghy was used for was, if you really didn't get someplace in fast, you wanted to get all four engines online. And if you needed to keep the battery floated, because everything on board runs off the battery, everything's electric, including your propulsion. Those are not direct drive diesels. The diesels are driving generators, which run electric motors, which propel the screws.
So it's like a locomotive, like a diesel train.
Absolutely correct. The whole system is exactly like diesel locomotives. Exactly. Matter of fact, the engines are the same. We had four of them squeezed in there. When I went to the Sea Fox, we had one of the engines taken out and the dinghy, so we had three engines. And all the crap that was below the control room, which was called the pump room, and you can figure out what that meant. You know, a lot of all of the air and water was moved back and forth, and that was some of it was controlled in the control room, but the machinery for that was right below the control room and the pump room. They took that out, moved back to the open engine space. And as electronics kept getting more and more, the diesel submarines had no space to keep up with them. So we moved the latest electronics down below the control room in the old pump room, and that's where the sonar was. And the radar was still up in the conning tower because, frankly, you didn't have the radar on much. So...
And then they went and they said, you know, we're going to still be on the surface a lot. So, you know, we've been taking all these waves and we want to go faster underwater. So they smoothed the bow out. They called it it's a guppy bow. You can look up what guppy means, greater underwater propulsion. And they have different guppy classes, guppy 1, 2, 3, 2A. You know, I forget which one is which. So the Sea Fox had a rounded hull and what we call the northern sail, which was 30 feet above the deck. And keep sailors from making mistakes. If you were up there and they rang the diving alarm, you rang the diving alarm. The officer of the deck way up on the bridge up there is the one that rang the diving alarm, okay? And he sent his lookouts and everybody below, and he went down last. But, you know, sailors being sailors, the easy way you would think to do that is you'd have a ladder going all the way down to the conning tower. No, you had a navigation bridge right under the open bridge. And then you moved over and you went down a little more, another level, and you went into the conning tower. And the ladders were at different positions, so you actually had to get off the ladder and you could not slide all the way down and smack your head as you fell into the conning tower. It's called sailor proofing.
Oh, well, I guess that makes sense.
But it was one of those 30-foot northern sails, and this was a regular occurrence. We would take blue waves up there quite regularly, and if we were on the surface, because if you're caught on the surface, you stayed. You didn't try to submerge in it, and we would take blue water over pretty regularly. And like I told you, it was windy one day. I reached over the side, not feeling well, and leave a little out of my guts. And the engineer was up on the bridge, getting ready to go down.
Oops.
And oops is right. And he caught a little of that, you know. I don't know if he's still around. I don't know if he would remember that to this day. I haven't talked to him much. He lives up in
the. Sounds like something you deliberately forget.
Yeah, I was just going to say it. Doesn't sound like a memory you'd want to keep.
But so if, in fact, we had to be submerged, we aren't going to go below 400 feet. And if we were. Watch the hour to have, and you did, Alan, the blind man's bluff. And it's going to generate a lot of questions.
I'll put a link to that too. It's a History Channel movie based on submarine.
The book tells stories specifically, okay? But the authors of the book narrate the movie. And there's several people I know that were interviewed in that movie. I knew them later in life when they were long since retired. And I met them coming to submarine veterans meetings. But they'll tell you stories about that. Before we had the snorkel, in order to charge the battery, you had to run the engine to charge the battery. Therefore, you had to surface because the engine needs air. Mm-hmm. The snorkel's main purpose is to get the air for the engine. And it's only purpose. And so if you're in some place that you cannot surface, whatever reason it might be, and you need to charge the batteries, you have to get up to periscope depth regardless, and stick that snorkel up and hope for the best. And what happens is it has an electronic valve on a sensor on the head. So if it gets green water, blue water on it, it shuts the head and the engine stops taking air from the snorkel. What the engine does instead is automatic. It says all automatic. Starts sucking air from inside the boat. And then if the wave goes away, the head valve will pop open and the engine will stop sucking air from inside the boat and start taking air from outside again. What happens is, think about this. This is a sealed space. So what are you doing if you're sucking air out of the boat? You're turning it into a vacuum, are you not?
Yes.
So in each compartment, you would have a depth gauge in each compartment because at 311 feet, the front end bow could be at a different depth than the stern. And it didn't matter. What the depth counted was in control room and in the conning tower. That's the only depth that ever counted. And but you could suck air from inside the boat. And if you had more, and if it lasted too long, what happens, you'd watch the vacuum gauge. The engine had an automatic trip that it would shut down at 6 inches of vacuum, which is equivalent to being at 6,000 feet in the air. And you could watch, I could watch, let's say it's because it's me, because on the dive, I had a depth gauge, the big depth gauge and the more detailed depth gauge and a vacuum gauge right in front of me. And I could look over and see what speed we were doing, and I could see that on a Sea Fox, the helm was in the control room. On the Catfish and the Gundo, the helm was up in the conning tower. You could see what was going on. But you'd watch the vacuum gauge would spin like crazy, 1,000, well, 2 inches of vacuum, 3 inches. And many times it would trip the engines off, and sometimes we'd get up to 4 or 5 inches of vacuum, and it'd pop right back open. And this played more sailor talk hell on the crew.
I bet. Imagine your ears cycling between sea level and 6,000 feet in seconds.
And because the crew that was not on watch was in their bunks, and you're going to be laying on your side mainly, or if you were, you could wake up with blood all over your pillow from your ear bleeding. And I told you, Alan, there was one time I came on the watch holding a handkerchief to my nose because both sides of my nose were bleeding and both ears were bleeding. Because the seas were so bad, but we couldn't be anyplace else. We had to be there.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Wow. If you watch Blind Man's Bluff, you can figure out about what I'm talking about.
Yeah, that's. I highly recommend it. If you're interested at all, that's a great movie.
Is it on Netflix or?
It is on YouTube. I'll put a
link. YouTube.
Yeah,
okay,
I'll put
cool.
a link on the. It's a History Channel movie.
Based, an hour and 36 minutes,
yeah,
I think.
Yeah. Based on the book, and it mostly covers
based on the book. It's unbelievable. The book was much more focused on specific events and people. Okay. The first name mentioned in the book itself, and it had a great deal of discussion about him and his submarine, was Charlie McVane. And it was a whole chapter, and he was the first name mentioned in the book. And if you look through the movie, and you wouldn't know it, you would only know it if I pointed him out to you, okay? Because he was never mentioned by name. And it was a picture of him back in his younger days. I knew Charlie. I've known Charlie. He's still around. He's one of the big shots in San Diego for the Naval Submarine League San Diego chapter. And he's a few years older than me. But when I was in deep submergence, he had just retired from being in deep submergence. And you can look up the Seawolf and the Halibut and the Parche and the Pogie. You can see what they all did. And it's a lot of that's unclassified now because once the book was written, everybody said, geez, well, I guess we can talk about this all now. The book was written in the 90s, I think.
Right. And there was a lot. At what point, I know you did a lot of, the submarines, my understanding is submarines have always been like the secret.
Yes.
Service. There was, you by the nature of what you did, there was a lot of secret stuff you couldn't talk about.
Correct.
And at what point, did they go, did you kind of get the feeling, okay, we can talk about this now?
After the book was written.
Yeah. Was it kind of like, well, the secret's out, we might as well talk about it? Or was
what
it?
When I got the book, and Charlie's name is a name near on the first page of the book. And I called him on the phone and said, what's going on, Charlie? He says, yeah, we can talk about it. Okay, Charlie. That's all. That's the only authority I needed. He was long since retired. Let's see. When was I in deep submergence in 82, 83, and 84, something like that. I have to go back. I can tell you. I got that listed on my wall. It goes on. But he had just retired, and he was one of our contractors. And I got to know him quite well, and to this day, we still correspond. I've had him come speak at many of our events here in Green Valley. Let's see. I was at 81 to 84. I was in the Deep Submergence Project. And that was the stuff we did. And if you watch Blind Man's Bluff movie now, Blind Man's Bluff movie spent more time, a good portion of time near the end of the movie, talking about the divers cutting the cables.
Yes.
Oh, what cables are that? Yeah, everybody talks about it now. You know what cables we're talking about.
I love that story. That's such an awesome, like super sneaky thing, you know. And apparently the Soviets were like completely clueless about it.
Yeah. And now it's so big past. Yeah. Well, all the electronics today, none of that really matters.
Right.
But
could just tell because not everybody knows what the hell we're talking about. So if you just tell, just kind of go over what it was and what they were
doing.
Well,
it was, you know, sort of in the vicinity of some city on the east coast of Siberia that started with a V. That had a lot to do with it. Okay.
Yeah.
Has any of you figured that out yet, or do I need to have a test? What?
Vladivostok.
Yes. Anyways, and there we go down and tap the cables. That's not in class anymore. Anyways, divers, hard hat divers did that. What the movie does not tell you, but it's not classified, is they were saturation divers.
Could you say what that means?
That means they were going much deeper and prepared to go much deeper. And well, I don't know what the mixture is that they breathe, but isn't that the mixture that they breathe that they dive very high?
Yeah, it's helium and oxygen. They have to purge their entire system with from nitrogen. So they sit in like they breathe helium and oxygen for hours until all the nitrogen's out of their body, and then they can go down a lot deeper than somebody breathing like a regular mix of nitrogen and oxygen.
Yeah, now, when I was in Deep Submergence in San Diego, it was called Submarine Development Group 1 and 2. And let's see, we were West Coast, so we were 7th Fleet. We were Sub-Dev Group 1. And Submarine Development Group had all kinds of things. And one of the vehicles that the development group had that came under the Commodore's command was something called the DTV Elk River. And DTV stands for Diver Training Vehicle. I have been aboard the DTV Elk River, and hanging with all my souvenirs and hats from my different days of things, I have a hat from the DTV Elk River. And nobody knows, can figure out what it is. But I know. Now, when they came back aboard the submarines, they had chambers they had to live in for a while before they could go back inside. You didn't go from surface ships. That's not classified anymore. Like I say, look up some of the ships' names I gave, submarines' names I gave. So, yeah, that was a big deal at the time that I was there. That was a very big deal then. Believe me.
it was kind of sneaky. They were going in and attaching. Basically, they were tapping the phone lines of the Soviet military.
Yes.
Recording everything that happened. And then most of this was unencrypted because they figured, hey, it's a direct phone line from one military base to another. Who's going to listen?
That's right.
So it was largely unencrypted, and they recorded they for years they were recording this stuff.
And it's more, it's clearer about that if you read the book, because the book goes into a little more detail about the operations themselves. But the submarines and they were called program boats, were specially designed. They were cut open and had extra stuff, you know, lengthened and stuff put in. I did serve on one boat that was longer than it should have been when I was on the Catfish. The Catfish was at the end of the era, besides the Northern Sail, it was given. Submarines have two batteries. They're called the forward battery and the after battery. The officers and chiefs live above the forward battery. The crew lives above the after battery. Now, stop, think about it. How dangerous, and these were lead acid batteries, so how dangerous, and you're in a saltwater environment, how dangerous is that?
Very.
Looking back on it, maybe, you know, we lived with it. Who cared? All we cared about is when we left, how did we get the diesel smell off of us, which we didn't. So that's all we cared about. But living above the batteries was not a big deal. But the Catfish had two extra batteries put in. And talk about being crowded, because all the refrigeration system, the refrigerator and the freezers on the Sea Fox and the Segundo were below the crew's mess. And had plenty of room and what have you. But they had to be moved up, and some of the crew's quarters were cut off and what have you. Now, what they did, and they did not lengthen the boat for that. It was just tight. They got smart, and in future conversions, they lengthened the boats by a few feet to take care of that. But so on the Catfish, we were really tight. But I have gone in all kinds of directions. So I think you've got, what is it, maybe from what I've written in my bio about things that you want to ask about? We haven't said anything about the time. I spent my longest time at sea on the Francis Hammond and the surface ship.
Oh.
And I went back into submarines when I went to the Deep Submergence Project, which was later on. And I did.
Why did you choose to do that? Or did you choose?
This is if you look at the story I sent you.
Mm-hmm.
I'd always wanted, from my grade school days when I read about these, the old World War II submariners, and they wrote books about themselves. I wanted to be in submarines. And
so you were basically always crazy.
Yes, absolutely. I admit to that. And then, so I went, when it came time to go into service, and Vietnam was happening, and I was in college, and I was doing fine, getting good grades, no problem. I was going to graduate, but then I was going to be gone, and I was reclassified. Well, they told me that. And so I went down and said, well, I'm going to, it wasn't just because of the submarines. It was also because my dad was in the Navy. And I mentioned that he'd always said to me, he kicked himself for not staying for career. But so I went in and joined the Navy, and I went to the recruiter office, and I asked to be in diesel submarines, and they said, nope, they're going away.
Oh.
Okay. Well, I don't want to trudge around in the jungle, so I'm going in the Navy anyways. Okay, I got to officer candidate school, and then you fill out your dream sheet. And I put down, what did I put down? Diesel submarines. And so I said, no, you can't. They're going away. I said, find a way. They found a way. When I graduated from OCS, they still were having basic diesel submarine officer courses. They weren't very often. And when I went to a submarine school in London, Groton, we had six sections. Five of the sections were nukes. One of the sections, all 30 of us, were dieselers. And that didn't happen every time there was a class. And I had to wait several months, a few months, to get there. And that's when I was sent out of officer candidate school, got my commission, and went to the Segundo in San Diego. And the Navy was always, as much as all it sounds oy vey and complaining and how hardships this were, the Navy's always been good to me. It was always good to me. He said, you know, I'm from Los Angeles. How close can you get me? Say, hey, we'll put you temporary duty on the Segundo in San Diego. And that's as close as we can get you to Los Angeles. And so I graduated high school and college in Los Angeles, in San Fernando Valley.
Mm-hmm.
You know, back when it was called San Fernando Valley State College. Now it's Cal State Northridge. And they asked me if I wanted a new diploma, and I said, nope. I didn't graduate from Cal State Northridge.
That's right, damn it. And,
yes. I'm such an old-fashioned guy. You see where? No wonder I stayed in diesel submarines. But I got on the Segundo, and I was assigned to work for a guy named Jim Worthington because they knew I was going to be there long, he was weapons officer, and I was his what you call first lieutenant and assistant weapons officer. First lieutenant in the Navy. Is there a first lieutenant rank in the Navy? No, but there is a job. You're in charge of the deck. So getting underway and returning to port, you're in charge of making sure line handling goes correctly, and you're in charge of painting and scraping. And
oh, boy.
What a perfect job for who? A brand new ensign, right?
Yeah, that's right. Not so much to screw up, right?
And I didn't know this until later on. Jim and I remained in contact my entire Navy career. He stayed, I think, for 26 years. He had just made lieutenant when he went and just came aboard the Segundo, I think, just before I came aboard to work for him. He came from being the pilot of Trieste-2. You can look that up. The Triestes did, and you'll find his name listed with Trieste too. And he was a good guy. And I didn't find out
that was the Beth escape, right?
That was made the significant depth dive that was never overcome by way back in. Oh, God, when was that? And by who? You know, I keep forgetting. I'm having a senior moment here in Green Valley because the pilot of that, after he was on the Trieste-1, came to the Sea Fox way before me. But, you know, he's been on, I think he's passed since then, but he was on my distribution list for stuff. And I tried to get him to a couple of our reunions. But, I can look it up. I'm not going to look it up. It wastes too much time looking it up now, but we can do that another time. But Jim was, Jim and I remained in contact throughout our whole Navy career. I ran into Jim at a bus stop in Northern Virginia near Washington, D.C.
What? At a bus stop.
Wow.
We got on the same bus. Oh, boy. And I think after I retired, it could be true, it could be false, but there was some indication that Jim had something to do with getting me into the deep submergence problem. Yeah.
I hope that's a microwave and not a bomb. I'm just saying.
That was the microwave. Okay. Sorry.
It's all right. And the other thing I never knew about him and didn't find out till afterwards, you know who my longtime friend Jim Worthington was? James T. Worthington III. And you ready, Brita? This is for you.
Okay.
Of the Worthington, Ohio Worthingtons.
Oh.
Well.
Yeah. Oh, boy. Wow. That and a dime won't get me a cup of coffee.
Right.
Oh, man.
Now, what have I missed in terms of my history, in terms of the Navy?
I'm sure
I haven't
Vietnam or any of that stuff.
Yeah, we could do another whole 12 podcasts with you.
Yeah.
Probably, because now we haven't even talked about the stuff I wrote you about.
Yeah.
You know, the views on people looking down your noses at anybody 50 and older.
Yeah.
Well. Not being able to do anything anymore. And I
Jay and I are quickly approaching 50.
Yeah, I'm a lot closer than you
are. I'm telling you that if I don't know if you showed them the picture of me that I sent you, Alan.
I think you sent it to everybody.
Mm-hmm.
I sent it to all of you.
Yep.
Guy standing next to me, 91. He lives right around the corner from me, and he's into he's into doing things. He's getting quieter now, but. We had another friend of ours who was 91 who used to ride in, may he rest in peace, ride in parades with us. We have what's called the parade once a year, white elephant parade. It's a white elephant parade. And so they have a parade once a year, a big deal. And we bring our model submarine down, which is a model of the USS Tucson. Clearly it would be the Tucson. And we tour it in the parade, and we have a chase car. And in the chase car, I sit in the chase car. And it's a convertible. We put the top down, and we have our remaining World War II guys sit on the top and wave to everybody.
Cool.
And Ralph, we couldn't go 100 feet or 200 feet at all without some quote-unquote young lady for the age of Green Valley, waving, "Hiya, Ralph! Hiya, Ralph!" He was 91, okay?
Mr. Popularity.
Yeah, no kidding.
At age 73, you look around my neighborhood, I'm a teenager, you know.
Wow. Arizona must be the place to go.
Well, it depends on what you're going for. If you ask the question, why is a sailor in the desert?
That is a good question.
You ought to know that answer. That answer is you walked inland carrying an anchor on your shoulder. But he said, "What on earth is that?" You settled. Why did I come to the Valley? Because of the Navy. Yes. In Tucson, every year, there used to be a function honoring Pearl Harbor, the USS Arizona. There's a big Arizona memorial, and the Navy, a Navy related organization of veterans called the Fleet Reserve Association, used to run that event. And I was in the Fleet Reserve Association back in Northern California. As a matter of fact, I was a branch president back there, and call them branches. And they kept saying, "You got to see this. We got to help out. We got to see this. This is a great thing to see. You got to come. You got to come." So I started calling and checking, and the guy says, "You don't want to go up to Tucson. You want to live in Green Valley. You want to come down to Green Valley. You want to come down to Green Valley." Okay. So one day, I had a week, took the time off, drove to L.A., and then from L.A. drove to Green Valley, stayed in a motel that's almost a hop, skip, and a jump away from here because this town isn't that big. When all the winter folks are here, we're about 30,000.
Mm.
But, and they're starting to come back now. But, so I looked at some homes in Green Valley, and then I said, "Oh, show me some in Tucson." I looked some in Tucson. I said, "Go back to the first home I looked at." Okay. And to this day, 15 years later, I live in the first home I looked at.
Nice.
And it's Green Valley because it was connected with the Navy. And there was a very active Fleet Reserve Association branch down here for the longest time. By the way, Alan, it's Navy, Marine Corps, and Coast Guard. Sees all the services, okay?
All right.
What requirement is you had to have at least one day of honorable enlisted service. "Well, Joel, you're an officer." "Ah, officer candidate school is..."
That's right. You're enlisted.
Enlisted.
Yep.
The rank is OCUI-2, officer candidate under instruction, second class, E5.
Yeah. And if you wash out for some reason, you get to go be enlisted somewhere.
That's correct. My roommate did. Mm. Yes. Joel, is that a bad sign? Hey, that never turned out to be a bad sign. Yeah, and what were the first three things that I got at Officer Candidate School? A haircut.
Yep. That's the first thing they do for everybody.
A uniform, and what's this third thing? An M1 Garand.
Oh, really? Wow.
That I had to carry around and own, and maybe, you know, boy, you better not lose that.
That's wow.
Greatest implement ever created by man.
Yeah, that's a good. I was thinking of trying to find one because that's the first real something. You know, my dad and mom had some firearms, but we never really did much with them. When we all lived back east, see, we moved all over. This living here in for 15 years is the longest time I've lived in any house my whole life.
Hmm.
That's because of the Navy and because my folks moved around a little bit too. They settled down eventually. I was born in Chicago, so we lived there at my grandmother's house for a while. Then we moved to a housing project for returning veterans. Then it was a place called Mount Morris, Illinois, which is a little tiny town. My dad always called it Mount Moisha. He Jewishized it. Okay. Anyway, because R.R. Donnelly then. And then moved to Milwaukee, Wisconsin. He was a printer. He worked in the press room at the Milwaukee Journal. And we moved there and lived in a house while they bought a house. We lived in an apartment while they bought a house, and we lived in a house for several years, and they decided they were going to go to California. So they sold the house and moved into an apartment in a different part of town, so I had to change high schools in my junior year. I went from second grade through 10th grade, and that only adds up to, what, 11 years, right?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, less than that, 9 years, 10 years, 11, something, I don't know. I can't count. Well, how the hell, Joel, did you ever get to be an officer if you can't count? Yes. And so it was, and then they came to Los Angeles and rented an apartment until they found a house. And I went to the high school right around the corner from the apartment and graduated from that high school. And then lived in the house for my 4 years of college. And then was gone and never to return. And, of course, moved 9 times in my first 4 years in the Navy.
As one does.
Huh?
As one does. That's the.
That's right. Now they got nice. They got kind to me after all, you know. And they were cutting. I kind of when you know they managed to keep me in San Diego for my submarines. When the one was going out of commission, they moved me to another one because I was already headed off to Supply Corps school. I had already been selected for Supply Corps school. And if you read my thing about Shall Not Be Infringed that I sent you, I was augmented into the regular Navy. I was a reservist. So that's where the term regulate comes from, being regular.
Mm-hmm.
And we actually all those who were not reservists but were, you know, graduates of the academy and what have you, and ROTCs, they were in the regular Navy. And so then and then they were very kind to me after Supply Corps school because I had to go to Vietnam twice on the Hammond. And so they let me go ashore in Long Beach. Hammond's more important than Long Beach. And so they let me stay ashore there. Number one daughter was born at Naval Hospital in Long Beach, California. And she's the one that's on Broadway, okay?
Oh, you have a she's a actor?
But you mean you didn't read my short story there? I say she's on Broadway. Yes, that Broadway.
I must have missed that part.
Okay, let me read you her advertisement. Again, okay. What did I tell you? She's a Navy brat. Did I tell you that? Yes.
Yes.
And she was born in a naval hospital, right? And here's her advertisement that I love this advertisement because it was posted on the wall. First and only actress to play leading roles in two off-Broadway musicals at the same time. There were One Night with Fanny Bryce and Sylvia Fine and Danny and Sylvia. You can look them both up. There's things that she did. They're not. She still does the Fanny Bryce stuff, and she takes it around the country. And here's her advertisement. A sassy, brassy, comedic, New York Jewish broad, sarcastic wit, quirky charm, and penchant for playing historical women of the early 20th century. All right? This is a David Bratt, okay? In other words, she must be good at what she does, right?
Yeah, no kidding.
Plainly, she sings and does very character acting. You go to KimberlyFayGreenberg.com and go to the video stuff, YouTube stuff, and she's and you one after another after another after another, but you'll see the different things if you want. You know, toot, I get her tooted in,
well,
and it's the other daughters, grandkids that were thrilled with being part Irish.
Joel and my fellow squirrels, I have to be going. I actually am going to help my son, who will be joining the Navy in June of next year. Joel,
he's doing what?
He is going to be an air traffic controller.
Oh, okay.
He will be on an aircraft carrier, or probably at a base. But
in this day and age, he may be on the carrier.
Well,
we need those guys underway.
Like I was saying, you know, as a dad, his other choice was explosive ordnance disposal.
And, hey,
as a dad, I was very happy to see him choose air traffic because he's either going to be at a base or on an aircraft carrier. And the last time someone attacked our aircraft carrier, we nuked them. So I don't think they'll make that mistake again.
Well, he could have gone on a submarine and become an electronics tech or.
Yep.
Or on a submarine. Well,
he's right at the age. He's like 6'3", 6'4", so he's almost too big for a submarine.
That's another thing. When you tour the World War II submarine, you're going to look around and figure out, how the heck did the tall guys get on these boats?
Oh, I would probably be very comfortable there then.
But folks, I do have...
Yeah.
Okay, Jay. Thanks, Jay.
And actually, we need to. We're well over our hour, so we need to.
I know, and I bad for me. Slap my hand twice.
No, it's totally worth it, Joel.
Joel, we'd love to have you back.
Yes, we would. Let's go ahead and wrap this up and say goodnight, and we'll be back next week.
Send me an email or call me on my landline. I'm still old fashioned. When I'm at home, the cell phone is off, and I use the landline.
Oh, wow.
Okay.
Because I have a desktop computer, I've got all my stuff on.
Okay. All right. Well, we'll be back next week, everyone, and have a good weekend.
Thank all of you out there. Thank you for listening to my constant yapping.
All right.
Thank you, Joel.
Good night.
See you next time.
Good night. Bye.